You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, listeners, one of the big issues, if you will, politically at the moment, but I think it goes deeper than just politics, is questions around the Treaty of Waitangi, in particular the whole idea of did Māori cede sovereignty or not? And that's come back to the fore because of comments by the Leader of the Opposition, Chris Hipkins, of late. He said that Māori did not cede sovereignty. Other, you know, activists, academics and commentators have said the same. But as on all things, it's been alternative opinion. So I thought I'm going to turn to one area where you can actually get a little bit more sense, I think, and that's history. So I'm welcoming back to the show Professor Paul Moon, Professor of History at AUT. So Paul, welcome back.
Good morning.
Hey, first and foremost, thanks for being on a few months back as you talked us through your work on Anne's Westra. I've had a number of people actually comment that they enjoyed the interview with you, and they've been tracking down the book and photography since. So a big thanks to you for that.
Thank you. That's good to know.
I'm going to start really broad, and we wanted to come in, obviously, from a historical point of view because you're a professor of history. How do we even begin to answer the question around sovereignty in New Zealand, and particularly whether through the Treaty of Waitangi, Māori, as far as we can corporatise a whole lot of iwi, to what extent did Māori cede sovereignty or not? What does history tell us?
Well, I think the first thing is to consider the question, did the chiefs cede sovereignty? And that's a question that's ricocheting around at the moment, but it's a bit mischievous because it assumes that there's a fixed point in time and history is snap frozen at that point. And it ignores the way history evolves naturally. So there are two sides to it. The first one is what happened in 1840 when the treaty was signed, what did the signatories want, and then what's happened subsequently. And we can divide it that way. When it comes to what these signatories wanted, it seems to be quite clear circumstantially that the chiefs never gave away their sovereignty over their own people. And we know this for a number of reasons. Firstly, it would be highly improbable for one chief to say, you know what, I've had enough of all this power and authority over my hapu. I'm going to give all of it over, hand it over to this small group of immigrants. They can run my hapu from now on. That's highly improbable for one chief to do that. But the suggestion that 542 chiefs around the country would do it is bordering on absurd. Then we encounter a problem, because if you look at Article 1 of the English text of the treaty, it says all sovereignty goes to the Crown. The phrase is absolutely and without reservation. So there's no wriggle room there whatsoever. So how do we reconcile this? Well, then we have to look at what the British wanted from the treaty, the other party to the treaty. It's highly unlikely that the chiefs would give away their sovereignty, but were the British actually seeking to govern Māori as well? Well, the answer lies in the archives. There's not one document prior to the treaty being signed in which anyone from the British government or the Colonial Office or the Treasury says, we want a treaty with New Zealand so that we can exercise sovereignty over Māori. There's not one document that says that. However, there's any number of documents which make it really explicit that British are saying, we want a treaty so that we can govern our people who have gone to live in New Zealand, or another phrase is the Anglo-Saxons resident in New Zealand. The British are very clear. They want to extend jurisdiction to this troublesome population at the time in 1839, about 1,200 people or so, because that population had been in New Zealand for decades without British law applying to them. Britain had been very reluctant to do anything about it, but here we are in 1839 and they're saying, we've finally got to take some action to resolve this matter. We'll have a treaty that grants us absolute sovereignty over all Europeans living in the country. Now, that's the lead up to the treaty. What's significant is in the couple of years afterwards, that policy remained. So you don't get a single message or letter or report or document from Governor Hobson or a successor, Governor Fitzroy, saying that we've tried to impose sovereignty over Māori society and it's not working. Māori sovereignty remained intact after the treaty, and the first two governors in the country were quite happy with that. Now, if the treaty had meant that British sovereignty applied to everyone in the country, you would expect a lot of correspondence saying, we're struggling here, send some troops, send more officials, we need to somehow impose our rule on everyone, but that never happens. So And then, of course, you've got a famous letter from Lord Stanley in London sent to the governor in 1843 saying, apart from serious crimes such as murder, the two justice systems of the country are to be kept separate. Māori to govern themselves and exercise and execute their own justice, likewise for the settlers. So every bit of evidence conforms with that. So in answer to the mischievous question, did Māori cede sovereignty? No, they didn't. But to maintain that position, and this is what's known as an originalist position, to maintain that originalist position, you then have to block out all the history that followed. And the analogy could be used rather like a relationship. If you've been in a relationship for a long time and you say, well, my relationship is the way it was on my wedding day, that's a snapshot of it at its inception, but it would be highly misleading to presume that the decades that have followed have remained identical. So the nature of treaties, rather like the nature of marriages, is that they were loosely worded so that the relationship could evolve depending on circumstance. And if necessary, the relationship could break up if the partners decided they no longer wanted to be bound by it. So what we see for the remainder of the 19th century after the treaty was signed is what you could call a process of acquiescence, where the crown sovereignty over the country began to spread and many Māori communities accepted it. Now, some didn't. There was resistance and there were wars fought over this in small areas of the country. But certainly by the end of the 19th century, the amount of resistance had diminished dramatically and there were pockets of resistance even into the early 20th century. But by and large, New Zealand had evolved from being a colony based on a treaty to a single state based on things like the New Zealand Constitution Act with its own parliament, its own lawmaking function and so on. So the country transformed dramatically in the decades after the treaty, and that obviously affected that relationship.
So a lot to unpack there. I might, if you don't mind, start at the start, which of course, yes, mischievous questions. I find them very good for actually facilitating discussion. It's one of the things I do. But you just touched on, I think you mentioned like 1,200 settlers. And for me, that's actually sort of quite an important point, including too, you mentioned Hobson, that, you know, if in 1840, 500 plus chiefs plus all their people were going to just hand over all their power to 1,000 plus settlers and a couple of administrators, it does seem highly improbable, doesn't it, when you look at those sort of numbers?
Well, bear in mind that the treaty is between the Crown and Māori, so the settlers wouldn't have a role in it. So what they're doing is handing over all their authority to one lieutenant governor and four or five officials he has with him. That's it. That's entering into the realm of the absurd almost.
Which is why I think it's important to draw out, and I suspect for some people it may be uncomfortable hearing this, but we know in our own mind today we wouldn't hand over such authority to someone. The other thing we've mentioned before, when we've been talking off camera, so to speak, or off microphone, was that actually the British at the time sort of approached a lot of colonies like New Zealand as a business. I think that's how you referred to it. They weren't actively seeking to try and create whole new systems. I'm probably not phrasing that too well, but I think I know what I'm getting
at. Well, there were a couple of impulses for colonization. The principal one was to do with profit and commerce. So Gladstone later in the century described the empire, his words were, a vast commercial emporium. That's how they saw it, a place where there would be trade and profit, not just for Britain, but also for the colonies themselves, because the British realized that profitable colonies are friendly colonies, and ultimately they generate even more profit for the empire. So profit was the big concern, but by the 1830s, you get a new strain of thought entering into the mix, and that's what we'd call nowadays a humanitarian view. So, for example, Sir James Stephen, who drafted the instructions for the treaty that were issued in August 1839, he's also the person who drafted the legislation abolishing slavery in the British Empire. And there was this view that, a radical view for some, that all people are equal. Am I not also a brother, was the phrase that was used. And so, yes, on the one hand, you've got people saying, It's all about commerce and about expansion. But the British Empire expanded where there were commercial opportunities. New Zealand, really, there weren't many opportunities like that at all. There was some trade between New Zealand and New South Wales, but that preceded formal colonisation. Britain didn't need to get involved, and it was reluctantly dragged into a commitment to New Zealand because of this humanitarian impulse, the need to, as they make clear in 1839, to protect Maori from the evils. This is the term used in Norman Bee's instructions, the evils of colonisation. And so how do you do that? Well, you allow British jurisdiction to apply to British subjects living in the country. So they're no longer free to commit whatever crimes they want. They will be punished by the full force of British law.
Because up till then, I mean, I always think of the stories of Korerakaka or Russell. What is it, the hellhole of the Pacific? I know that was a bit earlier in time, but it was lawlessness because there was no law, strictly speaking. I mean, could Maori, as the dominant culture at the time, enforce themselves upon the settlers, or was that what was leading to violence and trouble?
Well, Hapu certainly had the power to do that if they chose. But what's interesting is by the 1830s, anyway, you've got various Hapu leaders, various chiefs complaining to British officials, sending letters saying, can you please do something to restrain your subjects living next to us? They're a bad influence on us. So they were very aware, acutely aware of on the one hand, having settlers nearby was useful for trade purposes, but there was also a rogue element among the settlers that no one really wanted around. And so when you've got chiefs themselves saying, you know, Britain, you need to take care of your people in our country, and that tells you how bad it's getting.
I know some people will be now thinking, but what about Hobson's famous words, apocryphal or otherwise, that we are now one people? What's the response to that? Because a lot of people will lean on that this treaty formed everybody under the British Crown. And yeah, we are now one people. What does history tell us about that?
So you've just purchased a house and the real estate agent says to you, congratulations, you're going to love it. Well, any spoken comment made in the aftermath of signing an agreement isn't binding on the agreement, because otherwise you'd go back to the real estate agent 2 years later and say, look, my house is mouldy, it leaks. You said I'd be happy. I'm not happy. I'm going to take action. Now, that can't happen. So people are free to make whatever statements they want. It doesn't impinge on what's contained in the text, and it certainly doesn't really reflect what the instructions for the treaty were. But even if you take all that out of it, the fact is that probably around 90% of the chiefs who signed the treaty never heard that statement anyway. That's because it was only made at Waitangi, and everywhere else there were other people circulating copies of the treaty for signatures. So even if it was heard by some people, it was heard by under, say, 10% of the signatories. And even of those 10%, did they really take that to be a binding condition of the treaty? Unlikely. And let's say even if they did, and these are a lot of evens, what's meant by being one people? Does that mean we have our humanity in common? And the other thing, of course, is what happens afterwards? If that was true, if the implication is, as some people have it, that this means that Britain now governs all of the country and we're all British subjects, why is it that that never played out during Hobson's the entirety of the rest of his rule? It should have, if he meant what some people impute that meaning to say.
Which leads me to, and I'm not sure it was in Hobson's time, but there's the famous case. It's at Robertson Island, or that's how I think of it, in the Bay of Islands. Beautiful, three amazing lagoons to snorkel and dive in, I have to say. But there was the cases at Makatu, which I think illustrates how the law was being applied post the treaty. You just want to take us through that and explain what that illustrates.
Yes, there's a teenager called Makatu who killed a settler family and their farmhand. Now, the farmhand happened to belong to the local hapu. So the local hapu were enraged by this. They apprehended this murderer and said, we're going to execute him, because that's our approach to this sort of thing. Hobson intervened and said, no, this young Maori boy, only 18 years old, he actually killed our people, so we should have jurisdiction. Now, this is roughly 2 years after the treaty was signed. So who has jurisdiction? Both groups say some of our people were killed by this person. So the hapu relented and said, okay, fine, we're going to watch and see what happens in your system. So Makatu is brought to Auckland, put on trial. He's executed. It's a public execution. He's hanged in 1842 in the corner of Queen Street and Victoria Street in Auckland. It was the first example where, for a serious crime, where British jurisdiction extended to someone who was Maori, a full 2 years after the treaty was initially signed. And that prompted a flurry of activity in Britain. They said, well, look, yes, maybe. And they hummed and hawed and said, okay, this is a serious crime, we understand. But apart from such serious crimes, this is the instruction to the governor from Britain, you cannot intervene in Maori affairs like that. And that lasted until, say, 1843.
Which in itself is fascinating, which again, why I'm so grateful for you coming on, because there can be so much politics and agendas around these debates. I can say that as a former politician, everyone has their motivations. You know, if you lift up the hood and look underneath what is driving a lot of the questions and concerns, they're not often based on the history, which is why it's just interesting to tease this out. I mean, one of the things which often gets put to me from different Māori that I've dealt with over the years, including through my own family, on my in-laws' side, not my own, but long and short, iwi that did not sign the treaty. I've often debated this with friends. If you're going to sit on the "we've ceded sovereignty" side, well, what does that mean for people who didn't sign the treaty at all? How do we reconcile that these days?
Well, there's various ways that's been done, how the circle has been squared. The fact is, you're right, there are a number of major iwi which either didn't sign it because they didn't want to or were just not approached. It raises a question, can you be bound to commitments in an agreement that you haven't signed? Now, the normal response should be, no, you can't be. Then the question becomes, well, in that case, can the descendants of those iwi that didn't sign, can they then say, well, look, we're not governed by the Crown, we're not governed by New Zealand law because we never gave our commitment to the treaty? Well, there's two ways that can be responded to. The first one is it was responded to in legislation in 1975 when the Treaty of Waitangi Act was being put together. The drafters of the Act admitted, they were scratching their heads, and they admitted this is a problem. Who is covered by the Act? Who can make a claim? And they decided that rather than disentangling something that would be enormously complex, because you've got many generations since and people might have ancestors on one side that did sign the treaty and one side that didn't, how does that get reconciled? To simplify what otherwise would be almost an impossible tangle, legislators decided that every Māori would be covered by the treaty. It's a blanket that covers all Māori because that means that everyone is eligible to make a claim under the provisions and principles of the agreement. So that's how it was resolved in that sense. But in a way, that reflected a bigger trend, which was that this process of incorporation that took place after 1840, and particularly after the 1870s, where more and more Māori are de facto British subjects. So they're treated the same as everyone else. They have the same rights. Some of the discrimination in early legislation started to disappear. And so the idea of equality of citizenship was a process of acquiescence. So Māori became members of a single sovereign state. And sometimes through force, it has to be said, sometimes at the point of a gun, sometimes with some of those communities suffering enormously. But certainly by the time that the Treaty of Waitangi Act was signed and passed, rather, in 1975, the view was that all people are represented by the state. We're all subjects and citizens, which raises a problem in itself. Because if we're all British subjects, who is a treaty between now? If we're all Crown subjects, who is a treaty between? Now, treaties typically between, or it was in 1840, between Māori and the Crown. It's an international agreement between two sovereign states. Now, effectively, it's a domestic agreement within a single sovereign state. So we're really stretching the elasticity of the definition of a treaty at the moment.
Definitely. And one of the things I'm always struck with in some of the spot in the more political debates than the historical is different sides. And I wrote actually a Substack on this a while back of how opposing sides on the treaty are actually operating the same, because often they're just wanting their view to be the predominant one. And, you know, the very nature of a treaty is two partners. There's two people involved. It seems to be lost on the extremes on either side.
Well, look, if you listen to a couple that's going through a divorce, you know, if you listen to one of the parties, they'll be saying, oh, he did all this and he was like this and he's a rotter. And then he'll say, well, she did all this. You won't get an impartial view. Historians try to go to incorporate all views, which makes us universally unpopular because everyone thinks, well, why don't you support me? Why don't you support them? So not all historians, I might add. There are some who are who do allow themselves to tilt based on ideology or politics. But by and large, you know, our job is to discover what happened and why. And for whatever I've said today, I'm quite happy for someone to say, you know, Paul, you've got this wrong. Here's the evidence. Here's the document that says, you know, Britain had an entirely different view of things. And if that's the case, I'll look at the document. And if it meets the criteria, if it's legitimate and so on, authentic, then you adjust your history accordingly. And that's what all historians should do, be open to say, yes, I'm wrong. And if you go in with that approach, I think you're going to get a far more honest response. It's not going to be the perfect response. It'd be a very misleading historian who said, this is the only way to understand the past, my way. You know, it doesn't work that way. But certainly you try as much as you can to approximate the truth.
And that's why, for me, it was quite important to bring you onto the show, because actually we do have historical documents and sources which help us understand what was being said and thought of at the time, and that in turn should help inform us today. And I suppose just the last really quick point, if I've heard you right, you talked about an originalist position. So ultimately we can look back at 1840 or at set moments of time and say, look, this is what was being done at the time. These were the thinkings. But if I've heard you right, and please correct me on this, we've also seen in my term here an evolution since then. So what was noted as not ceding sovereignty at the time has changed, as you said, sometimes at the point of a gun and other dynamics, but actually there has been a change. Things have not stayed stagnant, if you will, or singular as of 1840. We've evolved as a country, which perhaps arguably, and I will try to phrase this as a question, it's why the debates are so fraught now, because what was is no longer what is, and we're trying to grapple and understand that.
That's right. And there's all sorts of reasons, historical, psychological, and political, that people defer to the origin. They go, this is the point of inception, the point of creation. Everything should be based around that. And there's some merit to that, but there are problems with it. US constitutional history is full of examples of why originalist interpretations are problematic. We actually can't get into people's heads to know what they were thinking at the time they signed it. We can't get the full context of the period. We can't get the atmosphere and so on. Plus, there's such a variety of motives that we can't stitch them all together to make one fabric out of it. So all sorts of problems with originalism itself, and also the fact that originalism requires us, as I say, to ignore anything that happens afterwards. So if you think of it as a relationship, think of the week your relationship started, and then you say, well, this defines everything about my relationship. We've had 30 years since then, but it doesn't matter. It's just that week that counts. That's how I'm going to define it. And there might be some merit in that. There might be some nostalgic value, some ideological purpose. But the reality is things evolve enormously. And you have to take into account the whole of the history, not just that snapshot.
Which is one of the things that keeps historians busy and people within the political realm well challenged. So, Paul, thank you for taking so much time to talk us through this and to give us, I was going to say a snapshot, and I'm using that because actually it was a broad discussion, but there's so much more that could be added. But you've given us a lot of that historical context, not just around the signing of the treaty, but to also situate it in the almost 200 years afterwards. So look, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking us through.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And so everyone, that was Professor Paul Moon. He's a professor of history at AUT University here in Auckland.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.